CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talk's Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club Downtown Liverpool and Business. And every Sunday, we look at some of the week's big business stories and talk to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider northwest region. This week, UNESCO confirmed that they are seriously considering withdrawing Liverpool's World Heritage status. Will the city finally be rid of this vanity badge that stifles development and regeneration? Liverpool Football Club have announced that they can no longer see any viability in redeveloping Anfield. So what of the future for the Reds and indeed the Blues? And as last Sunday saw the closure of the News of the World and the Murdoch clan seemingly prepared to sacrifice almost anything to eventually get their hands on BSkyB, is print media dead? To discuss this and to look ahead to Liverpool's premier business event of the summer, the Liverpool Business Awards, I'm joined this week by a man who always flies with the Eagles, the irrepressible John Haynes, Paul Brandt, the deputy leader of Liverpool City Council, and the managing director of Waterfront magazine, Phil Harris. Good morning, gents.
Good morning.
Morning, Frank.
I wonder if I can come to you, Paul, first. The obvious question, the UNESCO committee have apparently deemed that some of the developments that are taking place down on our fantastic waterfront, which has been modernised beyond belief over the past decade or so and is continuing, in my opinion, to go in the right direction, but it doesn't meet with some of the criteria, apparently, that they lay down for us to retain that status. Now, for me, it would be absolutely fantastic news if they decided to take that badge off us, because I think it's been an absolute nightmare, more of a barrier and a hindrance than a help to development. But I guess people who've been involved in campaigning for World Heritage status, people who actually think that it's important to have that sort of badge attached to some of the great architecture that we've got down there and we do like to celebrate, would say, well, no, we've worked hard, we invested hard to get it, and we should do what we can to keep it.
Yeah, I think that the accolade of a World Heritage site is a way of demonstrating to the rest of the world the iconic nature of much of what is in Liverpool city centre. It's not just, of course, the waterfront. It includes much of the central business district, and many of the buildings are absolutely up there as world-class buildings. But I don't think that it's anything like as bad a move for the city as it's sometimes portrayed, this intervention by UNESCO. The reason is that they keep a bit of a watching brief on these World Heritage sites, and whenever there's any large-scale development, they like to come and satisfy themselves that it's sympathetic to the status of the site. They did it when we had the Liverpool Museum plans coming through, and sent a delegation in similar terms and satisfied themselves that quite iconic but modern architecture on the waterfront, indeed right next to the Three Graces, was not only satisfactory but was perfectly in accordance with the World Heritage Site. So we're quite confident that they'll come into the city and they'll go through the plans with us, and they'll be satisfied that the regeneration of the docks, it can be done without in any way adversely affecting the World Heritage Site.
But what value does it add, Paul? I mean, I'm not being disrespectful here to UNESCO or to the Heritage Lobby, although I do think that they've been far too powerful a voice in this city for far too long. But, you know, the idea that because we've got that badge, people know about the Three Graces is a nonsense. I mean, our waterfront was world famous before UNESCO was ever even thought of. So the idea that they can come along one day and say, oh, well, do you know what, guys? Because you've developed and regenerated your city centre to look like a modern 21st century go-ahead city, we're going to consider taking that status away from you. My view would be to say to them, well, do you know what? You can have it. Because the other problem with it, and you hit the nail on the head, really, it's not just about the waterfront and the Three Graces. It impacts on the rest of the city as well. And this so-called buffer zone, you know, over the years, the number of times our planners have actually said to developers, oh, you can't do that because it's in the buffer zone. And it actually means that people don't invest in the city. They see it as a difficult place to come and do business. I don't see the advantages.
Well, we're very keen to make sure, as a relatively new administration now, just in for over a year, that the planning powers of the city are operated in a way that encourages investment, encourages business. And indeed, that's one of the reasons why we worked to get the enterprise zone in the Liverpool Water Zone, which will, if the government say, give greater devolved planning powers to us. And we'll be taking full advantage of the greater degree of autonomy that planning controls are now meant to have or meant to be given to local authorities. I would say that in terms of the some of the architectural splendours, although most people in the country and the world are aware of the Three Graces on the waterfront, the fact that we've got such a rich heritage in the city isn't always as internationally or nationally known as you might expect. And one way of demonstrating that it isn't just us who say that the city is fantastic and world class, but there is an independent benchmark from a world organisation, can mean that it's easier to attract investment, tourism, and others to the city, and forms part of the draw. So those who operate in the sector will often tell you that it's part of the rich mix of getting people to come and visit the city, and the tourism and visitor economy benefits as a result.
OK. John, what do you think about UNESCO, our friends at UNESCO?
Well, I believe, Frank, possibly when you go into a negotiation like this, you should always see for the other... The other person's eyes, the city's eyes, and they've come in with just one view: a win lose. We're going to win. You're going to lose. We're going to withdraw the heritage site. And it was interested what Andy Green said. This could be the best thing that ever happened to the city. But I'd just like UNESCO to calm down and realise wrong assumptions at the root of every big misunderstanding. And they should really look into exactly what's going on in this city. I do believe if we do lose it, myself personally, I go to different cities in the world that they're doing my seminars. And the Liverpool brand is now starting to increase. There's a good perception about Liverpool, and I've got to say this, the heritage site does add to that, but if we lost it, I think it'd be bad form on UNESCO. I just believe at this moment in time that they should stand back, listen to our city councillors, listen to Joe Anderson, and possibly they'll have a bigger view on this. I do not believe, Frank, they've got the full facts.
Phil, I mean, your magazine's named The Waterfront, and okay, Paul has made the point very well, that it's not just about our waterfront, but that is the iconic Liverpool vision, isn't it? The Three Graces coming in on those great liners that we see now. So where do you stand on this World Heritage Site business?
The Three Graces are the vision, but there's, I think what I'd like to know is, well, you know, what is the value to the city of the World Heritage status? You know, I mean, you're talking about, you know, a private company here who's prepared to put in £5.5 billion worth of funding into an area that needs it, and the ongoing economy that's attached to that is so important going forward. I mean, who knows, UNESCO could pull their status, you know, in a couple of years, and then we will have lost this bid. You know, Frank, as you say, they'll take their money and go elsewhere. They've got no reason to, other than the economic reasons of investing in Liverpool. I think that's important to the city, important to the region, and most important to the economy of the region.
I mean, what concerns me is that obviously you're referring there, Phil, to Peel's proposals. They're already getting a fair degree of criticism from some people, largely, again, I have to say, Heritage Lobby, but not exclusively. What's your sense, Paul? Do you think that Peel would be reluctant to continue developing those proposals, those plans, if, for example, it seemed inevitable that their proposals would be called in by the government?
Well, as you know, the planning application is in and is being considered by the council's planning committee. So, and that will be determined in the proper process and according to the proper rules.
What's the timescale, Paul? Sorry.
Well, because of the scale of the project, a much longer timescale is expected. I mean, this is a project which will develop out over 35 years.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, When the bid was originally put in, it was fully understood by both Peel and the council that there would be a process of dialogue taking place then, which would refine and shape the application as it came in. And that's a dialogue that's taken place on a very constructive basis, I would say, by developers and others. Now, you've mentioned rightly the noises that have been made by some people who have sort of heritage interests, and they have a legitimate voice. But I would say to them and others that actually at the moment the docks are derelict and are not being used. And frankly, there are no real heritage asset to the city at all. And no doubt, you know, we're not some kind of heritage theme park in the city of Liverpool. We're a vibrant, thriving commercial district. And I'm sure they will want, when they come and look at the site and when they talk through the issues with us and Peel, to see the area developed sensitively, yes, of course, but nonetheless developed and attracting the thousands of jobs that would be associated with the development and reanimating that part of Liverpool, which is currently not, you know, which is out of bounds to most people.
And the point you were making, Phil, really, isn't it? You know, you go down to that part of the dock and it's tragic, really, isn't it? Because
absolutely.
City centre, this end, going towards Brunswick Quay, fantastic. You know, we've redeveloped, we've progressed, but going to the north end of the city, which is in urgent need of attention,
desperate,
very much needs jobs, investment, the sort of regeneration that we've seen city centre, and here we have people saying, well, hang on guys, we're not sure we want you to do that.
It's, to my view, that's wrong. That's wrong. I think there needs to be you know, more consideration for the area, and I really don't feel that UNESCO understand how desperate we are for development in the north of the city on the docks.
And although I take your point, John, about, you know, internationally that sort of status may have some contribution to Liverpool's newfound confidence, and, you know, we are a destination city now, and tourism is an important part of the diverse offers that we make, I have to say to you, you know, if you're sat in a house in Anfield and you're looking at all these fantastic things that are potentially going to happen, and it looks as though you're going to have opportunities for quality jobs, for the sort of regeneration investment that Peel are proposing, you ain't going to be that bothered whether somebody in Mexico or Brazil is aware of Liverpool because a UNESCO badge, are you?
100%, Frank. I just believe UNESCO hasn't got the facts. They haven't listened to the City Council, Joe Anderson, and they're just coming in a way as bully boys. In a way, we've got this, we're going to take it away from you. My big concern now is if Peel sees what's going on and we go for a government inquiry, they could pull out. If they pull out, that will be the biggest sin ever what's been cast over this city. So I just believe the Northern Dock area has got to be developed, and that adds to the brand of Liverpool. All I'm saying, I just think UNESCO has got to stand back, take a deep breath, get the true facts, and come back to the negotiating and start negotiating. And I do believe they should be doing that now.
I want to end this first part of the programme on a positive note. So, Paul, the museum opens this week.
It does.
It's a fantastic, fantastic, another fantastic addition to our asset base. Looking forward to it?
Absolutely. I think anyone who's been down on the waterfront, especially since the walkway has now been reopened, will be amazed by the quality of the building. It's almost literally in the sunshine a shining example of the best kind of architecture we have in the city. It's had an interesting history itself in terms of the planning process, but I have to say anybody who goes down there and sees it now will form the same view, that it is going to be as iconic on the waterfront as some of the Three Graces are now known to be. And whilst it was controversial when it was first put forward as a plan, actually the Liver Building, when it was put forward, was deeply controversial. Great iconic architecture always stirs controversy, and that's why actually I'm not surprised that this kind of response is as we see coming from the Peel proposals, because in a way the transformation of what they're intending to do on the North Docks area will create almost a new Shanghai on the Mersey. We will be adding to the iconic status of the waterfront, and I think actually the fact that there's a bit of controversy shouldn't be unexpected.
Mm. Okay, well, as I say, I'm looking forward to the museum opening as well. And if you can get yourselves down there, if you've not seen it yet, actually, you're in for a treat. It is a stunning new development. And I know the plans for the things that are going to be happening within the museum are equally impressive. But the final point I'll make on this, and I've said it before, and I'm no doubt say it again, we should celebrate the past, but we shouldn't live in it. Love to have a conversation with that UNESCO committee face to face, but I'm sure that's never going to happen. After the break, we're going to be talking about Liverpool Football Club and their plans, or otherwise, for the future of Anfield. Stay with us, we'll be back in a moment.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Oh, welcome back to the programme. I'm joined in the studio this week by John Haynes, the international Liverpool International Coaching Academy, Paul Brandt, the Deputy Leader of Liverpool City Council and the Managing Director of Waterfront Magazine, Phil Harris, Liverpool Football Club, through Ian Eyre, announced this week that they can no longer see any viability in redeveloping Anfield. So, what are the future for the Reds and indeed the Blues? Because we seem to have been having this debate about new stadia probably longer than UNESCO have been interested in our city, Paul. So, again, sorry to put you under the spotlight once again, but as far as the City Council are concerned, are there things that perhaps the local authority can do to assist the football clubs in getting to new stadia position? Or actually, is it because the financial restraints that both football clubs face at this moment in time simply mean practically they're unable to develop how they'd like?
I think we are ever since the credit crunch, the world of football is in a new financial landscape. Many of the clubs, although not Liverpool, many of the clubs struggle to make a return, and we're well familiar with the fact that if you don't have a rich benefactor, it's a different kind of operation than if you do. I think that the capacity of football clubs to raise money on the open market has consequently been affected by their financial status. And in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, they would easily have found money to redevelop stadiums. Now it's less easy, and if you can raise the money, then the terms are going to be more difficult. And no doubt, Liverpool is in that new financial landscape is in a new position, and that will influence the way in which it can redevelop and see its own plans proceeding. The new owners, no doubt, you know, although they have a history themselves of upgrading stadiums, but they will have had to look at the timescale for starting afresh. They already have got the planning permission and the consents to build on Stanley Park. If they were to change that, it means going back to square one. And whether, you know, everybody knows that that means a planning process, and these are not easy planning decisions. And because of the scale of the development, it's by no means certain that they wouldn't be reviewed by the government. So I think a combination of those factors is probably a consideration of all of them has left the football club saying that actually it doesn't have the time or the money to redevelop Anfield on the current footprint. So we have always engaged positively with the football club to try and make sure that they can carry on business properly. They're a major business, a major employer in the city, bringing enormous amounts of tourism. So they're vitally important to the success of us as a city, and we want to see both the football clubs succeeding. So we will continue to play a constructive part in that sense. Mm.
Did you sense that there was an inference from the club that city leaders could have done more, though?
Well, I don't think so. I think some of the coverage perhaps got the wrong end of the stick when they were suggesting that somehow that there might be a bureaucratic processes that would have to be encountered by the club. I think what they're referring to is the fact that if they want to expand the existing stadium, they'd need planning permission to do it. Now, they know, because they've already been through the process once, that you can't just double the height of a stadium without going through a planning process, not least because all the local residents who live nearby would suddenly find out that they're living in permanent, well, many of them, that they're potentially living in permanent shadow. Mm. We have a planning process to make sure that everybody who'd be affected by a development has the right to be heard, and the football club will know that. So that's not a bureaucratic impediment put by the council. That's just the facts of the world.
That's just law.
That's just the law. Yes.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about Robert Murdoch and so on later. Rupert Murdoch, sorry. Well, from the other side of the fence, John, you, myself and Phil, all big Evertonians, all desperate for investment. I mean, we're happy if we have a new seat every season when we turn up, aren't we? Never mind.
Steady on, Frank.
New stadium or a regenerated Goodison Park. But, Phil, it doesn't seem to be getting any better, does it, over at Goodison, investment-wise?
No. It's often a wonder to me why, you know, there's clubs like, I don't mean this disrespectfully, but like Birmingham, who have never been as big a force as us, that can find investments of, you know, tens of millions of pounds. Nobody seems to, or we certainly don't hear about any interest in Everton, which is a bit of a worry. I mean, again, we're in a close season. There's lots of talk about comings and goings at Anfield and other clubs, and yet very little talk about what's happening at Everton. You know, no new faces in, and not much going out, which I think is the problem. I think Dave Moyes has been told that you've got to sell to buy, and we haven't done that up to now. But in terms of the stadium issue, I think it's imperative not only to Everton but to Liverpool and to the city. You know, I've got friends in business who own businesses in Liverpool, and the economy has changed significantly since the lack of European football in the city, because that brings a lot of people who wouldn't normally come to the city here, filling restaurants, hotels, buying goods, and that has a major impact. So it's regardless of whether you're Everton or Liverpool, the economy is being affected in a big way. And I think that's perhaps something that the council also has to consider. I mean, I once heard that the council get special payment arrangements in terms of mortgages, lending money for buildings that you can pay back the council over, is it 999 years, and there's certain funding available for that, is there not? And maybe the council could contribute towards stadiums, I don't know, is that not right?
I'm not sure. I mean, Paul will know far better than I. I mean, I've always wondered why, you know, you look at Manchester, you know, the City of Manchester Stadium, okay, was built on the back of a Commonwealth Games, the hosting of the Commonwealth Games, but nonetheless, I think they have still a stake in that stadium as a city council. In fact, I think I read last week that they're getting a chunk of
20 million
of the sponsorship deal. Is that something that's ever been considered, Paul, do you know?
There isn't any specific legislative arrangement or plans that enable councils to build stadiums or to play a part in them in the way that there is in Europe, for example. I know some of the Spanish clubs, their stadia are owned by the local authorities. But you need to bear in mind that actually in the legal framework within which the Spanish councils and local government operate is very different. And in fact, they levy specific taxes on their population in order to pay for those. Now, here we have a long tradition of football being independent of government and independent of councils. And actually, I have to say, right at the moment, councils, I mean Liverpool in particular, has said that, you know, the biggest cuts in the country. We are out there trying to protect the vulnerable people in our community and at frontline services, and so far as we can, we just don't have spare cash to be getting involved with business opportunities that are out there for the private sector. And if we did start to intervene in terms of supporting one football club, inevitably we'd have to support both football clubs. And if we're doing it, then every other local authority would potentially have to do so. There are complicated rules on European state aid in intervening and supporting one private business when others don't get the same help. It would be a legal minefield. And I think the Manchester position is unique, really, because, of course, the stadia there was originally the Commonwealth Games Stadium, which was underwritten by Manchester Council, deeply controversially, of course, because it required an enormous subsidy. And if you speak to some of the council taxpayers in Manchester, they'd probably be less than enthusiastic about the whole scheme because they've had to pay for it over many, many years, and would probably say to people in Liverpool, listen, don't go anywhere near this proposal.
I just think because of the Manchester experience, and also obviously West Ham at the moment are due to move into the Olympic Stadium that's being built in London. Seems to me, you know, if I may use the term an uneven playing field there, doesn't it? Because, you know, there's two football clubs potentially. Well, City have got a fabulous stadium and are owned now by one of the richest families in the world. So, you know, I know that's nothing to do with Liverpool City Council per se, but nonetheless, it does seem strange that it can happen in one part of the country and not in another. But John, again, as another Blue, you're a little bit despondent and not necessarily got the spring in your step as we go towards the new season?
Still got the belief, Frank. I just believe, I think all football clubs are now starting to realise it's a business. I think Everton have definitely got to reinvent themselves. They've got to get the people at the top, I'm not talking about the football side of it, who've really got the business skills and the entrepreneurial skills to sell the benefits. I cannot believe, as an Evertonian, we've got so many benefits going for us at Goodison Park and nobody's come in. So there's something lacking there at the top. I believe with Liverpool Football Club, once again, I'm getting back to the branding. Yes, they must have gone through it all. I hope there's no misunderstanding with the Liverpool City Council on Anfield's part and the City Council's part, but I can't see that. So I'm a bit unsure what Ian Ayres was really working at. But I think Anfield has got the soul of most people in the city. It doesn't matter if you're an Evertonian or a true red. It seems to be with the Hillsborough and everything else what's gone on. And to move it away, it will have an effect on people's emotions, people's lives, even some people's livelihoods. But it's a business and it's change, and we've all got to go ahead with change. But I do believe when you look back in your own business, every business is made on decisions. And it's usually, I would say, fear again. I just hope the two football clubs make the right decisions in the next period of time for the legacy of for the new generation. I hope they've got this right.
I have to say that I think, and I'm not talking about just the existing administration at Liverpool, I think every administration at Liverpool City Council has been remarkably lax with Liverpool Football Club in particular. And understandably so. Because, you know, it's a political nightmare to take on Liverpool Football Club or Everton, you know, because they are two, okay, they're businesses, but they're equally part and parcel of our DNA in this city. So for a city council to say, well, hey, sort your act out here. But Phil, you making the point before about businesses being affected, they get visitors from all over the country for every Premiership game who walk through what I consider to be some of the more squalid parts of Liverpool. Not any fault of the City Council, not any fault of the people who live in and around that area, but because the football club haven't invested in the way they said they would.
Well, the clubs will say, you know, we haven't got the money to invest. And I think this just gets back to another issue of, you know, how much money is there to invest after players' wages, which is a, you know, a controversial thing at the moment. And, you know, we're talking about Manchester City and the controversy surrounding the stadium naming rights. It would be good if the clubs did invest, but I think the fact of the matter is you look at the company accounts and the money isn't really there to invest.
I think if I was a Liverpool City councillor, though, I'd be sat there thinking, well, you've just paid 20 million for a winger, who in my view isn't the best, and yet you've CPO'd some of that, or you've taken a lot of that property in and around Liverpool, left it derelict. You know, for me, it's not the way any business, and I'm not saying this as an Evertonian, I'd be equally critical if Everton had done this. I don't think that's right.
I think the other thing that was a bit surprising with Ian Ayres' comments is that the council came back and said these fundamental issues you have not changed now. We're talking about the lighting issue. You know, people have a right to light in their own home, and Liverpool want to build stands to block out light. Well, those issues have not changed before they put the planning application in. So why it's raising its head now and they expect the council, which is law, to change laws to accommodate them. I mean, I still think, perhaps as a biased Evertonian, that to give Liverpool Stanley Park in the first place was not right, because it's green, you know, it's communal land. I'm very surprised that happened, but it did. And, you know, I think the council have been more than lenient with them.
One word answer for this, because we're approaching our next break. shared stadium, Phil?
No.
John?
Yes, Frank, yeah. Shared.
Paul, have you got a view?
The business logic is unanswerable.
Mm. And I'm a yes as well. So I think it's 3-1 there. And hopefully that'll be the score in the first derby at Goodison to the home team in October. Anyway, listen, we've discussed UNESCO. We've discussed football. When we come back after this break, we're going to be discussing the hot topic at the moment, which is the Murdoch media empire. And we're going to be asking the question, is print media dead? Stay with us. We'll be back in a sec.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back to part three of the programme. And this week I'm joined in the studio by John Haynes, Paul Brandt and Phil Harris. We've been discussing a number of issues this morning, UNESCO and their views on Liverpool's World Heritage status, Liverpool Football Club and indeed Everton and their plans for new stadia, or not plans for new stadia as it seems to be at the moment. But in the news this week and for probably a fortnight now has been the news of the world, the Murdoch News International problems and difficulties and controversies. What struck me, guys, was how quickly Murdoch seemed to be prepared to relinquish one of the biggest news titles in the world, as far as the news of the world is concerned. Then there's rumours about him maybe getting out of newspapers altogether. And the reasoning behind this is because he is so desperate to get his hands on BSkyB. Now, OK, I know he's withdrawn his bid at the moment, but everybody is suggesting that that's a temporary withdrawal rather than something that's not going to be revisited. But, Phil, as somebody who is involved in a very successful magazine, maybe print media is making it too broad, but do you think the days of the newspaper industry are almost coming to an end now? The traditional newspaper, the Sundays and indeed the dailies?
Well, I think obviously nowadays you have apps for your phone where you can, you can subscribe to newspapers. But I'm obviously biased and would say that, print media is not in a decline as far as I'm concerned. But I think the Murdoch situation is unique because compared all the paper titles, the Sunday Times and the Sun and the News of the World, which is now defunct, compared to the profits he makes from the BSkyB side, I would say are fairly small. And I actually don't think in the long term getting rid of News of the World will make that much difference to him. I think he most probably will come back for BSkyB. But I still think in the real terms, the profits and that he was getting from the papers is nothing compared to what he thinks he can make and he has been making out of the BSkyB side of things.
I mean, John, you and I have probably been, buying Sunday newspapers since we were old enough to. I mean, my dad was an avid reader of the News of the World up until Murdoch started to change the editorial direction significantly, but he's still got the Daily Mirror sat on his table when I go in there, now. But I and my kids don't buy newspapers anymore. I buy the Sunday Times and that's about it. Do you think we're changing our habits as far as the way we find our news out is concerned, John?
Yeah, definitely, Frank. It's I was doing some development work with some graduates from John Moores University about entrepreneurship. And I had a copy of the Daily Post and they were all, in a way, a newspaper. What are you doing with a newspaper? And not one of them, these youngsters, buy newspapers. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the media print, it's a cash cow. It's gone, Frank, and eventually it will be a dog, according to the Boston Matrix. But I think Murdoch has been very clever on this to say, I'm not going to put the bid in for this anymore. If he had value, if he had integrity, if he wouldn't have treated his staff so harshly, we might have gone along with it. He's got a hidden agenda. He knows media prints is dead now and he's putting all his eggs in one basket. And that's the
and
way
it's BSkyB.
BSkyB, 100%.
Yeah, as I say, I think, I look across the piece. I mean, what I certainly read Waterfront, Insiders, a business magazine that I always read as well. But I do find that for my daily news, Paul, I'll tend to go for the bulletins that come through my inbox on email, you know, so it can be all sorts of things, the Daily Post, the MEN, Business Desk, you know, there's lots of things now that you can access pretty quickly. But again, what was not surprising to me, but I think to some people, has been as this story has unfolded, the number of warnings that our politicians had about some of the underhanded tactics that were being used. And I don't think the News International are on their own, by the way. I think there's other things that are going to be unearthed as this story continues to develop. But politicians were almost implicit in it, weren't they? Because there is always that reluctance, and having been a politician, I can say this, to criticise newspapers and journalists because you've got to have a relationship with them.
It's almost like a dance of two scorpions, the media and the politicians together, because we both need each other, but we both need each other to have a professional distance in order to work properly. We need to, as politicians, to be properly challenged and to be subject to scrutiny. But we, as politicians, also need the media in order to act as an intermediary with the public, because it's very difficult to get your message out unless you've got the broadcast or the print media. Where I think that your comment that the print media is dead is probably putting it too high, in the sense that there is a rapid evolution in what's happened in the print media world. But if you look at some of the developments with, I think, Associated Newspapers, to do the Metro, the free paper, and they are managing to run a pretty successful paper, principally on advertising. You've got News International, which is a multinational, multimedia company, but most of the voting shares are held by the Murdoch family. And actually what we're seeing, in my view, from News Corp, I should say, is that they are trying to put a firewall between the rest of their operations and the now toxic, contaminated News of the World brand and potentially News International newspapers. We'll have to wait and see what the inquiry comes out in relation to that. But Rupert Murdoch, has a history of making his way in print media to start with. James Murdoch doesn't. And there's obviously a succession strategy which Rupert is trying to put in place to make sure that James takes over control of the company. He wants the broadcast side of things expanded, and I think we will see the Murdochs and therefore News Corp prepared to jettison their British newspapers if they feel in any way that there's going to contaminate their worldwide and particularly their US operations. Now, that in some ways that's great, because I absolutely loathe what the News of the World stands for and wouldn't do anything to it if it was on fire as an individual newspaper, not the premises, of course. What I would say is that actually the Times is a pretty good newspaper. And there is a... In all the schadenfreude at the moment, that I'm thoroughly enjoying seeing Murdoch getting the kicking I think he's well long deserved, I think in a more reflective time, I think as a politician, I appreciate that having a press that does feel able to challenge and to criticise and at times, if you like, be unfair, that's the price we have to pay. But to act with full latitude is an important part of a democratic process. I think parts of the press have been out of control. They have been a feral beast in recent years. And we're seeing a rebalance, a shifting back of that power, hopefully towards Parliament a little bit more, but more importantly, towards the rule of law. This concept that they could do what they wanted, the law didn't apply to them if there was an, in quotes, public interest, end quote, by which they often meant the public were interested in it rather than anything else. You know, we're all interested in what David Beckham gets up to in his private life. That is not, in my view, anything genuine in the public interest. I think we're seeing a fundamental rebalancing of the distribution of power in our society, and it's been unhealthily shifted towards some of the print media, and they have been operating as power without responsibility.
It was incredible as well, wasn't it, the way the mood shift in the country when it went from celebrities who were obviously getting big payoffs to basically keep them quiet about what had been going on, and people were saying, well, you put yourself in the public eye, you're almost there to be shot at. And I think the same view people have of politicians as well. I mean, I, as a politician, I always assumed the phone calls I'd be making would be getting tapped. In fact, people, and there's a true story.
Yeah,
this,
if you can
people,
make it a bit more interesting.
People,
you,
yeah, exactly. I mean, I used to feel sorry for the police who were listening in, but true story, we actually were getting phone calls through to my house that were going straight through to Chorley Police Station, which was quite interesting back in the 90s. But I never felt at all fazed or bothered by that. But then as I say, I think people's views were reflected last week with the Millie Dowler story and then all these other things that have been uncovered. I mean, again, Phil, as someone who's involved in media, is there ever justification, even at the celebrity status, of the sort of intrusion into privacy that we've seen? Wait, let's say footballers, who not many people have got sympathy with, you know, but do you think it's right that they should be getting the phones tapped and people should be getting paid large sums of money to say what they've done after hours and so on?
I mean, my personal view is I think it's wrong. I think it's it's an infringement of your human rights. I think if there is a genuine belief that it's within the common interest for people to know certain information, then perhaps so. But I think to run of the mill tap people's phones is a bad way of journalism and a bad way of getting information. I don't agree with it at all. Absolutely not.
I mean, if they tapped John Ains's phone, they'd be in business forever, wouldn't they, because of some of the stuff he was up to. Just another point on the politics side of it, though, Paul, if I may. I watched Gordon Brown's contribution to the debate. I bet you wish he'd have performed like that when he was Prime Minister, don't you?
Well, they do say revenge is a dish best served cold. And I think there's a lot of people out there in News of the World have crossed and done outrageous things to in the past. I mean, having your family members and you know a young son's medical history splashed over the newspapers is frankly outrageous. Whilst it may well sell newspapers, I think it's an indication as to how people do, in fact, have a right to privacy. One, I would say, that's been implemented by Parliament, because we have an Act of Parliament that gives people a right to privacy, and it's been interpreted by the judges. But the media had, and the tabloids in particular, a full, whole-scale onslaught about 6 to 8 weeks ago on all these injunctions. And they ran, a scurrilous campaign, attacking members of the judiciary, attacking, using sympathetic politicians to use the cloak of parliamentary privilege to try and bust open some of these injunctions. And there was a real threat to the rule of law in this country. Newspapers were behaving as if they were completely above the law at that point and trying to undermine it. And as we now know, were in fact for a long period of time before and actually breaking the law themselves through tapping phones and other similar things. And it was an example of an overmighty press. They are fundamentally important to keeping our democratic system operating properly, but only when they share that power with the elected representatives and they act within the law. They were behaving well outside that remit, and I'm glad to see that power has been rebalanced in a more healthy way now.
And let's just hope that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, because I think you're absolutely right, Paul. We've got to have a free press, and we've got to have a press that scrutinises, that ensures the Parliament, politicians and powerful people are basically accountable to us. But equally, it has to be done in the right way. And the thing that really disappointed me about the Sun's reaction to the Gordon Brown stuff was they said, well, we gleaned that information legitimately. Well, even if they did, what was the public interest in that story? I just couldn't get my head around that. But we don't have to do anything about the Sun in this city, because Liverpool's had it right about that particular newspaper for a long, long time now. Just last couple of minutes of the programme, guys. We've got the City of Liverpool Business Awards coming up on Thursday at the fantastic Sefton Park Palmhouse. It's a sell-out event. We're delighted at Downtown to host that this year in association with Liverpool Vision and Jaguar. It is going to be a great night, but tinged with a degree of sadness, because I know Roger Jonas mentioned this on the programme last week. An absolutely fantastic lady called Claire McEwen was tragically killed in a car crash. 32 years of age, one of the most creative talents that I've had the pleasure of working with. And I'm sure, Paul, in your job, you come across Claire on many times.
Yeah, and it's a sad loss. I mean, it's always terrible when anybody... Anybody loses their life at a young age, particularly in a tragic incident like a car crash. But the role that's been played in making the city a better place will be sadly missed.
She was instrumental with the Shanghai Expo. She played a fundamental role in delivering a very successful Capital of Culture in 2008. And she was playing a key role in the Liverpool plan and worked alongside me and a number of the downtown team in that particular position. She was, as I say, an absolutely fantastic lady, be missed by everyone who knew her. And so the City of Liverpool Business Awards night will be dedicated to her memory. It'll be a celebration of Claire's night, and we're really looking forward to being able to pay what I'm hoping will be a fitting tribute to her. So look forward to Thursday night. Thanks for your company today on City Talks Business. We've had the pleasure of the company of John Haynes, of Paul Brandt and of Phil Harris. Thanks, guys, for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thanks, Frank.
And thanks to my producer, Jonathan Dean. Mostly, of course, thank you for listening. Have a fantastic week and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. Listen and log on to great music and great conversation on City Talk 105.9.